Do we need any prep?
Just jump into it. I think we should just go for it.
I'm Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capizani.
Welcome to another episode of A Hostile Climate. What are we doing today?
Okay, well, we're doing an emergency recording episode.
Is there an emergency?
It's always an emergency.
We live in a constant state of emergency.
Yes, but basically, we haven't weighed in on like a million things that have happened in literally 10 days. But now that we have information officially of who's running in this election, we can offer...
What does it mean for climate policy? What does it maybe mean for climate policy? We don't really know yet, but you know, where could this be taking us?
Look, I really want to talk to you guys a little bit about how we think about climate in the context of these ballots that we're seeing, and we'll focus on top of the ticket, but also whether and to what extent climate is being communicated in the election. I think many folks are predicting that it's simply just not really explicitly being named.
It's falling down on the list.
And what we think about that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Increasingly, in a way that I actually did not think was going to be the case. So, but also,
well, perhaps so most hang on though, because, well, yeah, okay, yeah. What's most important?
No, well, most important is that we didn't have to reach very far for our resident. Do you call yourselves Minnesotian? What is the Midwest?
No, absolutely not. Okay. Minnesotan.
Minnesotan. Okay. I don't know. As
you can say like two syllables.
There it is. Californian.
That was so like, that was like very pedantic of our like Californian to be like, so like, is that like Minnesotian? How does am I saying that right?
Yeah. Well, I'm part of the West Coast elite. So coastal elite. So I needed to clarify.
So, wait, so Minnesota, that's like a state or, am I getting that right?
Well,
I've been reading a lot about Minnesotans. See, I'm saying it right. Ways of seeming nice but serious, and so I think that's helped me in the Tim Walz decoding of his language that I've read too many articles about this week. I now will understand you better, but maybe Cody, we should reintroduce you and describe your credentials, including the camo hat that you're actually wearing that you own.
Cody's always here, here, but not always on this side of the microphone. So, you know, what should the people know?
Well, I'm not a current Minnesotan, but I am a lifelong Minnesotan, and I grew up in the same area code that Tim Walz represented in Congress. I feel like he's been in my life in one way or another since he got elected. Didn't really think anything of him other than that he was like the school teacher, military veteran that went to Congress. That all made sense, of course. And then he became the governor of Minnesota when I was a reporter, still kind of a reporter, but I was doing it full time then, and I found myself writing a lot about climate related things he was doing in the governor's office, and I was like, this guy really cares about it. I think that was like the big headline, and so like from a climate POV, I was really glad to see him jump on the Harris ticket. I think it was like if she was going to be hamstrung into picking an older white gentleman from the middle of the country, you know, why not my former governor and someone who did a lot for climate in Minnesota. I think probably the biggest law that everybody's been like touting as his like signature climate accomplishment was a law requiring the whole state of Minnesota to go fossil fuel free by 2040.
And that was an update on original commitments, right?
It was, yeah. I was kind of going back through, like, trying to remember from when I lived there, stuff I was writing about, and it was earlier in his administration. He was like, we'll do 2050. And he did this weird thing in climate politics where the actual law wound up being better than what he was advertising it to be. And this was after my time covering things, but he apparently in 2023 signed into law over 40 climate initiatives.
Yeah.
I believe one of them was like to streamline energy permitting in Minnesota.
And selling it as a type of permitting reform, which I think maybe we can start out with your obvious, like perfect intersection of expertise as an environmental reporter and someone who's a local constituent on maybe talking a little bit about climate records of a ticket, how significant that is for thinking of it on the run up, and also to maybe talk about Walls in particular in terms of his ability to communicate about the initiatives that he's doing. But I guess, so maybe my first question on that was, well, maybe this is just a personal question, but if you asked your former self way back when you were reporting on this sort of stuff, would you have ever thought about him on the national stage in any way?
Honestly, yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't, he wasn't super public to my knowledge about like wanting to do this, but I saw this New York Times story that, basically his office about a year ago just started to, I want to say it's about a year ago, but started to see, hey, we should be ready in case there is an opportunity. And of course, in the last couple of months, there became this huge opportunity. He was the head of the Democratic Governors Association. It was looking like our president was going to maybe not run for re-election. And so there was potentially going to be a window for him. And I mean, I wasn't surprised, I guess. I was kind of glad to see, you know, like a very like public service oriented person from the middle of the country, getting a look on the national stage. I thought that was just probably good for everyone. Definitely good for my part of the world.
A teacher with no stock, you know, investments and extra property and, you know, a lawyer and that kind of a background. So an actual civil servant background.
Yeah. I mean, he's got this kind of like ideal politician resume. And so I guess I wasn't super surprised.
Given like not being necessarily surprised about it, maybe this is more of a question around vibes. But one thing that I've noticed that I found really welcoming by how he talks is being able to speak directly to people, use plain language, and hone in a lot on the importance of community. Referring to people as neighbors, even when they are people, right, that he's talking about that he potentially disagrees with. This kind of like general messaging of, you know, a commitment to wanting to make like very specific impacts on people's lives while you are in the context of having the power to do so. And then actually having, you know, you just said he passed something like 40 or so bills just related to or measures just related to climate. Yeah. So actually showing that government can do things and can move quickly to some extent to respond to people's needs. So I think that's an interesting context with which to maybe talk about what this might mean for climate and environmental.
Yeah, I think you see that in stuff. His communication style. Like he, as he was doing this very, very public, obvious tour to get the VP pick. He talked so much about this like free school lunch program in Minnesota. Like he wasn't using like any blanket terms to say like, you know, he wasn't like framing it as this like big social issue that fits under like a sort of policy umbrella. He was like, no, kids are actually better in class when they aren't hungry.
Right.
And I think to tie that back to like is the way that I think this campaign will and already is talking about climate. You know, they're not talking about the Green New Deal. They're not talking about like any sort of like even vaguely resembling like climate fiction type of new all electric utopia. They're talking about clean air and they're talking about clean water, which I want to bring Alex in here because this kind of hits on one of your big themes, which is that climate is boring.
So boring. It's so boring, but it's a good thing. Like, I don't know. I'm continually astonished by how complicated like policymakers it seems like deliberately trying to make climate. Like the root of why we got into this problem is I think truly is kind of complicated. I think it has to do with like deep challenges we have with restraining ourselves. But like at a practical level, climate change is caused by too much greenhouse gas, and we know how to emit less. It really is that simple. And there's a lot of straightforward collective action that can get us out of it. I think this is actually a good time to maybe step back and also talk about the bigger sort of context of what the two potential administrations might do on climate. I mean, one thing we could do is we could look at what the first Trump administration did and what the Biden administration did, right? Like the biggest international collective action to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions of the last, you know, 50 years since this has been a problem was the Paris Agreement, and Donald Trump took us out of it. And he and now VP candidate J.D. Vance have positioned themselves as not just pro-development, but very pro-new fossil fuel development, right? So they want to open up a lot more federal leases for oil and gas exploration and oil and gas development. The Biden administration restricted a number of lease sales on new oil and gas development, put us back into the Paris Agreement, and passed the IRA and the infrastructure bill that had a lot of provisions for renewable energy generation and infrastructure that will support electrification. So we could just say, like, okay, those two administrations have sort of two different approaches. One seems to be sort of very pro-development with fossil fuels in mind. The other is very pro-renewable energy development. So it's likely that if we had another Trump administration or a Harris administration, we would continue one of those, you know, we would continue those two approaches to the problem generally. And I think those two approaches, again, climate change is boring. Like, those two approaches are the difference. That sort of federal government approach, I really do think, does make the difference. If we emit more fossil fuels, this will be a worse problem. If we don't, we can start to solve it. you know? So
it's that simple.
I think so. I mean, I also think, like, well, I think that it's become one of these, like, political, it's become a wedge issue for reasons that I don't entirely understand. But now that climate change is a wedge issue, it's just a political flag that can be thrown on the field one way or another, right? And one of the ways it's used is to sort of signify this kind of, it's this rallying cry that I think seeks to really divide people in a way that's extremely vicious. And this is true across political rhetoric. Like, I think political rhetoric, one of the things I love about Tim Walz is his rhetoric. Like, I actually think we can't understate the value of, like, the way in which he talks to people, and even the like, those guys are weird meme. I think there's such value in that. He doesn't say they're, like, terrible, bad people that want to destroy the country. He's just like, oh, like, they're kind of weird guys, right? As soon as he was picked, I saw, you know, there was one of the Trump campaign emails sent out said something like, and I'm going to get the exact quote wrong, but it was something like, Tim Walz wants to, like, rain hell on America. You know, it's some, like, real extreme language like that. And it's not just from the right. From the left, there's similar language around a potential second Trump administration. And I think the more we sort of feed that kind of rhetoric, the more we just create a world where no matter who wins, 70 million people in the country think that sort of an evildoer who seeks ill for them is running things. I mean, climate has sort of become, unfortunately, part of that narrative, where it seems like increasingly the right sees people who are worried about climate change as people who, like, want to do them bad or want to steal their livelihoods or something like that, which isn't the case at all, right?
Especially in swing states, right, with oil and gas that has a pretty significant role in Pennsylvania in terms of economic stuff. So there's been a bunch of boogeyman scaring around, Kamala and the ticket's going to ban fracking, even though there's actually not a lot of evidence that she's made explicit commitments about banning fracking and things like that. So you can see already the sort of catastrophizing that happens around any kind of potential climate initiative that comes from the right, is saying it's going to come for your jobs, your livelihood, you can't eat your burgers, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, we were talking about this recently, like, a lot of it comes from this fear of change, right? And I think that comes largely on the right, that climate change is used as this bludgeon to say, like, hey, they want to change everything about your life. They want to make you drive a different car and have a different job and so on and so forth, and it's going to be more expensive and disastrous. But also, the concern on the left is fear of change, is that, like, no, climate change is scary. It's changing, you know, how we live, where we live. It's changing the climate such that we need to shift. So there's actually, I think, this real, like, I think maybe that's a place for empathy across the political spectrum. And I think maybe we need to do a better job of communicating that across the political spectrum. Yeah.
So this is a communication issue, I think, first and foremost, as well as a substantive material issue. I want to make that distinction to some extent, because one of the things is that we now have a ticket where part of, you know, at least, you know, for the Dem ticket, we have some legacy of policy track records, much less for Kamala than we do for Walz to some extent. We, you know, have the sort of perspective of the kinds of things with respect to the environment. And
I think we can consider the Biden legislative history sort of part of, you know.
Right. It's inherited.
It's the Biden-Harris administration. I think we have to consider that Harris's position to some extent.
Yeah. But so to that point, right, then if we're thinking about some ways of extending the Inflation Reductions Act, you know, that kind of, you know, Bidenomics approach, lots of, you know, carrots rather than sticks for industry when it comes to the transition, like you were mentioning. And then a lot of the things that we can, you know, get into detail with Walz. What I have found somewhat interesting is what is getting messaged and what is not getting messaged so far on the campaign explicitly around this sort of thing. And I'm wondering if that's maybe a point of conversation.
I'm curious to what extent you think it matters. I mean, both of you, like, to what extent do you think it matters? I'm actually really curious, like, obviously this election will have a huge impact on climate change policy, but I'm wondering to what extent climate concern is relevant for the election. Like
do you mean for votes?
Yeah. From a voter perspective. Yeah. Like, I don't mean from a, like, sure. Ideologically, I'm concerned about climate change. That's why we do this. Right. To what extent does it matter for, you know, what's its impact on election outcome?
Yeah. I mean, I can give my two cents and then Cody, I'm curious, you know, what you're thinking too about this. But so a couple of things. I think one thing is really interesting. If you think that the argument now with Biden stepping down and Kamala stepping up, that the ticket is galvanizing a whole bunch of voters that otherwise felt alienated, including a lot of young people. Mm-hmm. One of the things that young people are explicitly saying that they care about is climate. And what's really interesting is if you're not necessarily, like, there's been some surveys going around that a large majority of youth, when you ask them what the IRA is, or if you ask most people, the Inflation Reduction Act, most people don't know what that is, let alone knowing that it's a climate bill, right? And so, and let alone being able to connect the dots on that sort of a thing. So one thing is if you keep environmental justice or climate policy sort of, if you're not connecting the dots for voters, that's one potential missed opportunity for connecting to a constituency that actually sees that issue as much more important than maybe other types of constituencies. Whether, of course, you're going to think about how that works in the sort of electoral map and the questions about how significant that is in particular swing states and districts that need to be won, you know, maybe that's more of an open question. But so there's that element, I think, that might be significant in terms of galvanizing voter turnout. But it's an open question about whether that's significant enough. But I do think alienating young voters, people deciding to stay home rather than showing up, if you're going to keep this kind of momentum of bringing more and more people in to be excited about the ticket, maybe that's one way to keep working on it.
Yep.
The flip side of that is if you make things very explicit about a climate, and this is, again, I've got some different views on this, so we can talk about that in a second. But if you're thinking about districts that are being impacted, those sectors and those jobs being impacted, if you're not really explicit about naming the things that the Biden administration helped to do in those areas, to talk about the kinds of improvements that happened locally, right, from a federal policy. Of course, there's a huge time lag with the IRA because a lot of the kind of infrastructure development and things like that are going to take time for people to see those impacts. But to be able to actually connect the dots between here's policy, here was impacts on the ground that happened, and here's the consequences of potentially losing that, and here's the potential for building a future that, you know, pushes that even forward and wanting to bring people in. So maybe trying to, you know, message explicitly, and you maybe don't need to make that a climate language. Maybe you talk about that as a jobs language.
No, right? I think that's exactly right. I mean,
something like that.
Like, we have the largest piece of climate legislation ever. At the same time, we had record job growth. in the country. Yeah. So like that story, I think, has huge power. I also think a really important part of that is down ballot races. So national presidential elections get decided by very few voters, right? It's a very small number of voters in swing states that end up deciding the election. But national turnout has huge impacts on down ballot federal and state elections. And the more you galvanize voters, even in very blue states, right, the coastal elite states, if you drive turnout, you can end up having huge impact on how those local, state, and down ballot federal elections run. And so I think that there is a there's a huge way that climate ends up having state level impacts if it's part of the Harris-Waltz campaign.
Yeah. Well, messaging. And one point on that, and then Cody, you should come in here, especially with your expertise as communicating around this in terms of reporting. The last thing I'll say too about, you know, bringing in youth and things like that is also expanding those messages. So also talking about climate policy or development as, you know, bolstering good secure jobs. So bringing in trade unions, right. And thinking about labor explicitly in that context, talking about housing. So you can talk about like discrete issues like housing resilience or talk about, you know, people's everyday expenses and sort of connect where and to what extent climate resilience or climate policy kind of feeds into those everyday concerns. But one point on this is I think not only around communicating about this, the ticket should show while they're campaigning to be listening and to be willing to be pushed by bottom-up forces, right? So like the IRA is not a very populist bill. To some extent, right? And it is a very kind of technocratically seeming. But you should be okay with people showing up at rallies or, you know, the Sunrise Movement getting galvanized again and being able to, whether it's showing up and protesting or wanting to talk to you about bringing that sort of attention, for there to be a sort of reception to wanting to listen to those people moving forward. So that's something too that I think they don't just have to message about what's been, but also to show that they're willing to have a kind of bottom up or even, you know, sensitivity to populist concerns when it comes to that stuff. But anyway, yeah, I'll shut up. Cody, what are your thoughts?
I think one thing I want to jump to off of the like listening to populist concerns is I think at least from the more progressive, further left base that the Democrats will need to win and also to affect these down ballot races is a couple things on each of their candidates' reputation, right? So there's this like narrative that like Kamala Harris is just an ex-cop because she was a district attorney, she was a prosecutor. And then the biggest kind of stain as it relates to his environmental climate record, Governor Tim Walz has a lot of people, specifically in Minnesota, and largely indigenous water protectors, other people affiliated with the water protection movement, who have not forgotten that in 2021, a tar sands oil pipeline that goes across treaty lands, across the upper Midwest, went online. Walz fought against this in his rhetoric for years. He was like, well, we're going to go through the process, and if it shows that this is, you know, like an unsafe project, we're not going to do it. He was against it. His indigenous lieutenant governor was opposed to it through and through. And obviously the pipeline is online. It was built. And, you know, on the like cop accusations note, Walz also let, I believe it was through the state of Minnesota, Enbridge, the pipeline company, basically funded like an additional police force to silence protest movements around Line 3. And I'm going to put some like links in the show notes if you want to get into the details, because they are complicated. But like Walz was, you know, and I don't know to what extent rightfully, I wasn't reporting on this super actively, but he was kind of put as like the boogeyman who let these, you know, let these police forces like go and arrest people protesting pipeline construction while they're in the middle of prayer, for example. That's like some of the like visceral images. And I guess I'm wondering.
Well, and that parallels some of the, I was going to say his response to Black Lives Matter as well. So there's kind of a reinforced track record there.
Yeah. And like, I believe everybody's concerns. I was not like, I had moved, just left Minnesota at this time. I wasn't reporting there. I don't claim to know like any of the details, but I do think these are all like legitimate concerns, right? And something that I wanted to ask you two about is like how, like what type of like frames of thought can we have for like holding that, you know, the Walz-Harris ticket is objectively going to be better for the climate than the Trump-Vance ticket. Like, I don't think there's any argument that you can make in good faith otherwise. Feel comfortable saying that as a journalist.
I'll put my academic expertise behind that as well.
Yeah, but also, like, people, I see in my bubble on the internet, people are like saying this is supposed to be a job interview and like we don't need to accept these flaws in our candidates, and people are just saying this as like a way to critique from the left the Harris-Walz campaign. And I see these like arguments like they aren't the best choice, we should maybe consider voting for a third party. Like, how do we hold these things?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. I think that in the last I think in the last decade progressives have really started eating their own. I think it's really interesting to watch. So like we know intellectually we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good always. That there are some things that, like, philosophically, I think there are some principles that we really need to sort of hold people accountable for, and that's where this comes from. So that's something I'm extremely not just sympathetic to, if that's what's driving people, but I really believe in, right? And philosophically, I'm not a consequentialist. Like I am I prescribe to a type of deontological ethical theory where I really do think that the principles that guide our actions are how we should judge our actions, not the outcomes they bring about. And that we have to hold people accountable to those principles. And I think that's where this idea comes from. So I'm really, really sympathetic to the notion that, hey, if somebody isn't supporting our ideals or isn't acting on, you know, in adherence to those principles we believe in, that
or
we need
showing
to hold them
inconsistency,
accountable.
Right.
However,
we
have two choices. We only have two choices. We practically have two choices because of our electoral system. And I think we have a responsibility to recognize the context in which our voting occurs. And if that's the context, it is not we get whatever we want or, you know, either of these other guys. It's we get this suite of government priorities or this suite of government priorities. And within that decision, there is no third party. A third party choice doesn't practically exist. You can vote for a third party, but you're just wasting a vote, right? You're actually, I would say, not you're not recognizing the power and responsibility you have in your vote. That doesn't mean don't hold people accountable. That doesn't mean don't tell Tim Walz that you think he did a bad job by not preventing a pipeline, right? There's a both and. It's not like you have to agree with everything anybody's ever done. Nobody agrees with everything anybody has ever done, right? Like, we don't have to say I am all for every single thing that Harris and Walz has ever done to think that they have a better overall agenda. I mean, I think that that's actually something that Republicans have done quite well around Trump. Is they don't believe everything he's ever done, but they at least recognize that that doesn't prevent aligning with him, which doesn't make sense to me for other reasons.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to thread that needle a little bit because I think for the most part, I'm agreeing with you on everything. I guess the one thing I want to say is that part of this challenge, I think, emerges out of the fact that we should not be regarding politicians, right, as like celebrities we're standing for. I don't know if that's the right use of that language, Gen Z. I'm sorry. But
no, you're good.
Okay, good. Thank you. hold me accountable here. And one interesting thing about, you know, what the Republicans have done has gone all in on cult of personality. So they don't even, they're not thinking whether they have disagreements or not disagreements.
No, but if you press them on it, they'll say, oh, I don't agree with everything he's done.
That's true. That's true. But I mean, they're so still like, line up for him.
Right. Like I have a lot of neighbors who are very Trumpy.
Yeah.
And I'll talk to them about it. And I'll say like, you're wearing that hat. You have that sign out. Really, what about, and I'll try to what about them? Because that's sort of like the first place to that we often go to with these. And like, I can't help myself. Yeah. Like, but what about the, you know, this, that, or the other thing? We'll be like, oh yeah, like I'm not going to defend that. You're like, huh? Oh, you just don't like everything he does, but you still like him. That's interesting. Like, that's I think there is a lesson there.
Yeah. And well, I think the lesson, I guess the view that I'm trying to say is that Dems or Libs or whatever should not be emulating that in this particular way.
Oh, you're saying like the hero worship. Like don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. I agree with that.
I just, totally. I think there was this kind of like blue MAGA contingent, right. That showed up when people were talking about Biden dropping out and there was this big push to say like, no, like put up and shut up, line up. But like the whole thing, right. That Dems offer a counter to the Republicans is like, if we are a big tent, lots of views can be held and here's how we're going to negotiate them. So I do think this critique of like putting up and shutting up, or oh, we got this new ticket, so now people can't have a critique. Like I've been seeing that now, where there's criticism of people, you know, holding walls accountable in the ways that you said, Cody, or same with Kamala, and I want to just say that like you're doing your civic duty, right? Especially if you're thinking yourself as a member, right, of the electorate, but also the body that politicians are supposed to serve, that we do have a responsibility, right, to argue for these kinds of principles, to say that, look, we're a constituent that needs to be addressed. That, though, is maybe distinct from, I think, the points that you're talking about, Alex, about the sort of pragmatic environment that we've have to
I'm saying there's a time and a place for that sort of productive accountability holding.
I think it's fine on the campaign trail, right? Like I actually think that's okay. So, but I think the question of showing up to vote or not to vote in this particular case, I understand that people, you know, have to
that's
vote
my
with
point.
Conscience, but yeah.
It's not try to say like, hey, let's do better. We should be always saying that of all of our politicians. Hey, let's do better. But like, if you're actually considering voting third party, you're practically speaking throwing away your vote.
Well, and that's where I think that the distinction just has to be made, like that Cody's question often, it's conflating these two things. It's saying the pragmatism about just showing up to vote or not going or throwing a third party vote away gets conflated as the problem of like any kind of level of critique that's being put forward in the run-up to the election is somehow problematic. Like, just be quiet, shush, let's win, and then we'll figure stuff out. And I think what's really interesting, and you can look at some evidence, right, if you think about Obama's run. So when Obama was campaigning in 2012, I think is the year I'm going to put it at, there were people at rallies arguing and holding him accountable about gay rights, and particularly the Dreamers, you know, were advocating for, you know, this kind of acknowledgement. And what's so interesting is like LGBTQ plus rights, Dreamers, right? Those are something that then the party like holds up as, you know, these kinds of examples of what the party can serve. But at the time, right, they were seen as disruptive of the Obama campaign. So I do think that there's this kind of responsibility and power to shift norms. And we know that that's not going to happen under Trump. And so the argument there is hold your politicians' feet to the fire.
Sure.
But you have to, they have to be there to be engaged with, I guess. That's my pragmatist kind of approach to it. But
I have another like pragmatic, this is sort of like this is both optimistic and pessimistic. I don't know what this is. This is my hot take. This is like the unedited.
The space we live in.
I also think that there is real political gains for both of them when they are critiqued by the far left, because it actually buffers them against attacks from the far right. So when progressives say, hey, Harris is basically a cop, that means that Trump and Vance can't say, oh, Harris is one of those crazy BLM protesters that doesn't believe in the police.
They'll like, say it anyway, but...
they might say it anyway, yeah. Yeah. But they have a much harder time saying it, right? The same way that when, like being... when there's critique of Walls for letting pipelines go through Minnesota, it makes it a lot harder for Trump and Vance to say they don't want any development ever. Right? Like, practically, those critiques do also serve a different political end in helping balance out some of the attacks from the right. And it positions them as moderates. And really, I would say they are moderates, right? Harrison Walls, like what this is about they're is they're not progressives. They are sort of moderate party line Dems, whatever that means today, right? We might disagree about what that means today, but in the current political landscape, they are not extremely far left progressives. They are moderate Democrats. And so, like, a lot of those critiques serve to prove that to swing voters, which, again, good, bad, or otherwise, practically could be very helpful.
Thanks for listening to this episode of A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by Alex Lee and Simona Capisani, and it's produced by me, Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. Just a reminder that A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're following us wherever you're listening to this. And if you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating and tell a friend. Thanks again. See you next time.